Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It hurts so good. Come on, baby, why you hurt so good? All right, I'm going to have to stop before I butcher any more of the good work of Mr. John Mellencamp. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And today we're talking about pain, that there are some masochists out there who think it hurts so good, like they want to eat super spicy food until their heads explode. And then there's probably you and me who would like to go through life with as little pain as possible. Now, we know that pain can be a good thing. I mean, pain is what helps us be aware that things in the world are hurting us. I mean, there are people who are born with medical conditions where they can't feel any pain at all. So for example, if their hand is on a hot stove, they don't realize it until they smell the charred flesh. So pain is something that helps us operate in the world. It really does keep us alive. But sometimes pain can be a bit overwhelming. We don't want to have to deal with it. I mean, I've gone to the chiropractor a few times after I lift the kids with my back instead of with my knees, trying to get them up and over things. So what I want to talk about in today's episode are issues related to pain, understanding it, its severity, and of course, those crazy people who are after it in the spiciest foods imaginable. So let's start with the issue of pain and the problem of pain scales. So when you go to the doctor will sometimes ask you, well, how much pain are you in? And, in order to rate that, they usually tell you on a scale from 1 to 10. I mean, right off the bat, pain scales can be problematic, trying to rank things from a 1 to a 10, because we have a hard time settling on extremes. Like, you don't want to go into the doctor and say, oh, it's really a 1, it's not that big of a deal. And you have a hard time fathoming what a 10 could be. I don't even think I've ever experienced any pain in my life that's close to a 10. I mean, maybe you've gone through a medical procedure, especially things related to like bone cancer or bone marrow. When I've read in literature and seen surveys online, people have said that's some of the worst pain that they've endured. I've heard other people who've dealt with things like kidney stones. Lord, I am so grateful you have spared me of pain that's a 9 or a 10. But so you can see how it gets hard to try to qualify in your mind, okay, well, what is a 9 or a 10 versus a 7 or an 8 or a 6? I remember when I used to do youth ministry, I would ask the students to rate their relationship with Jesus from a 1 to a 10. And the question wasn't super helpful because the students ended up saying a 7, an 8. 8 was the most common answer. Nobody wanted to say they got an A- or an A+. When it came to their relationship with Jesus. They just wanted to get through youth group without raising too many eyebrows. They would say they were an 8. So when it comes to pain scales, doctors are starting to see that just asking people to rate their pain from a 1 to a 10 makes it hard to diagnose pain. And when it makes it hard to diagnose pain, then it can lead to people having addictions to opioids, either under-prescribing pain medication, so they're in a lot of pain when they shouldn't be, or over-prescribing pain medication and causing people to be addicted to opioids, which is a crisis we've dealt with in this country in the past several years and afflicts a lot of people, especially in rural America. It's led to thousands of deaths from overdoses. And so you think, like, how do we avert this kind of a tragedy or disaster? Sometimes it's a very little thing, like asking someone about their pain in a way that's more investigative, yields more high quality answers than just, well, how do you rate your pain on a scale from 1 to 10? This is a story on NPR from 2018. Patty Naimond is the reporter. And the report is called Words Matter When Talking About Pain with Your Doctor. So I want to play a part of that where they have a doctor talking about how there's a difference between asking people to rate their pain and then just asking a much simpler question. Instead of a scale from 1 to 10, just asking a yes or no question can sometimes be better at understanding what kind of pain they're in and what sort of medication they really need.
Pain intensity has led to a sort of paint by numbers, if you will, or treat by numbers approach.
Instead of focusing on the intensity of pain, Markman says it might be more useful to also look at what the pain is preventing the patient from doing. Can they walk, exercise, focus? Is the pain preventing them from sleeping?
The way it interferes with particular activities are really what should be the focus of trying to treat them and take care of them, because that's what's most important to them.
Markman recently did a study analyzing data from patients who rated their pain by the numbers, but also answered this simple question.
Is your pain tolerable?
It turned out 3/4 of the patients in the study who rated their pain as moderately intense, 4 to 7 on the pain scale, a range typically resulting in higher doses of medication, also described their pain as tolerable, a description that normally means no more pain treatment is needed.
If the patient tells you my pain is a 6, but you know I understand that I have osteoarthritis and I'm accustomed to it, and it's tolerable for me, it changes the discussion you're having with them to, well, what's making it tolerable for you? How are you able to work around it? Rather than thinking, well, I need to give them something or do something for them to reduce that number.
So when we see this when it comes to treating pain, I think this is important because sometimes we see this in medicine and among doctors, especially in the Western world. I know, of course, I love Western medicine. I love being able to get antibiotics for most bugs that are coming after me. I love the quick access to surgeries and ability to diagnose medicine. It's awesome. But sometimes, given all the modern medicine we have, I think it's unfortunate that some doctors and other people embrace the idea that we ought to medicalize everything and try to treat every problem with pharmacotherapy, just with, well, we're just going to give you drugs. And if you have pain, if you have a problem in your life, if you have some kind of behavioral issue, even if it's something just like obesity, we think, oh, well, we just need to prescribe the right kind of drug, whether it's a painkiller, whether it's an appetite suppressant, whatever it may be, let's just prescribe the right drug to fix the problem. Instead of looking at the other way and saying, oh, well, maybe what this patient is dealing with is not a problem. Maybe instead of trying to prescribe a medication to make this symptom go away that the patient sees as problematic, instead maybe help the patient see that what they think is a problem isn't actually a problem at all, and that they have ways of coping with it instead of trying to automatically change how they feel with some kind of drug intervention or a surgical intervention. In fact, there's an article about this. It's a summary of an article in the New England Journal of Medicine. It's called Treating Chronic Pain: When How Much Does It Hurt Isn't Enough. And Jane Ballantyne was interviewed about this study she did in the New England Journal of Medicine. And she says, as my colleague Mark Sullivan and I explore in our article, pain intensity may not be the best way to measure how well the treatment of chronic pain is working. What's more important for people with chronic pain is their ability to function day to day and their quality of life. So asking people not, are you in pain, but can you do the things that you want to do in life, even if you're feeling pain, and learning pain management techniques instead of just trying every kind of drug therapy under the sun to remove the pain itself, because sometimes that can cause other negative side effects that are even worse than the pain that's involved, opioid addictions, things like that. So she goes on to say, for many people with chronic pain, keeping the pain intensity score low requires continuous or increasing doses of opioids. But this can worsen a person's ability to function in his or her quality of life. It may also lead to opioid abuse, addiction, or even death. The best way to treat chronic pain requires a multimodal approach that includes physical therapy, changes in behavior, medication, and strategies that help people accept pain. But physicians tend to resort to drug therapy because it is easy, it's what they've been trained to do, and it's the only thing they have time to do. Providing multimodal therapies in our current healthcare system is difficult. This is something we absolutely need to change. And we need other ways to provide what these doctors are calling multimodal therapy instead of just a very narrow focus on pharmacotherapy, on drugs, and maybe surgical intervention. So I found that to be fascinating when it comes to pain and how pain scales may not be helpful, like on a scale from 1 to 10. In fact, we have another kind of pain scale that we use in children because children, especially very young children, may not understand the difference between a 1 and a 10 and gradients and what's halfway or 3/4 of a way. So how do you get a young child to explain how much pain that they are in if they don't really understand their numbers? Well, that's where the Wong-Baker FACES pain rating scale comes in. It was developed by Donna Wong and Connie Baker. The scale shows a series of faces ranging from a happy face at 0 or no hurt to a crying face at 10, which represents hurts like the worst pain imaginable. So I'm sure somebody out there has this, because whenever I take my kids to their well child exam, I'm, you know, kind of spacing off a little bit while we're waiting for the doctor to come in. That's always the hardest part, right? I always wish they would just kind of wait and we would just be in the waiting room. They've got the toys that they're playing with that are covered with other kids' germs, you know, whatever. Sometimes you just have to let go in life. And then they say, all right, you can come back to the doctor will see you now. And you take them back and you go in there and the nurse, you know, weighs them. and then leaves, and you're waiting there in this windowless room, and the kids are like, what can I touch in here? Oh, cool. Are these like lollipop sticks? Like, no, those are tongue suppressors. No, don't empty the cotton balls. No, don't touch the sharp disposable needle tray. I always feel like, could you just wait and have me come into the room when the doctor is ready? Because then when you get in there, it's like you wait and the doctor comes around like 25 minutes later. Sorry about the wait. Let's see here and looking at the charts. So then how do kids figure it out? Well, I remember whenever I take my kids to their well child exam, I would see the faces. I didn't know they had a name before, but now you know they're called the Wong-Baker Faces Pain Rating Scale. And it had these little faces. And I always thought that the number 10 face is the cutest face ever to embody the most unimaginable pain in your life. I'm sure somebody out there has made a t-shirt that has rating 10 from the Wong-Baker scale. It's just like this little crudely drawn sad face with huge tear droplets coming out of the eyes. And so it's helpful in those contexts, not just for young children, but also it says that it's helpful for people who might have difficulty counting, might have mental disabilities, or have other impaired brain functions and have a hard time understanding a scale from 1 to 10 and instead can point to the faces. Oh, in the previous articles, they also mentioned that doctors are trying to ask people more about the quality of their pain rather than just its intensity. So it can help them to diagnose, not just saying it's from a 1 to a 10, but what kind of pain is it? Is it shooting? Is it sharp? Is it dull? Is it burning? All different kinds of things that are helpful in trying to determine chronic pain and in order to discover some of the hidden causes, whether it's dermatological, whether it's at the skin, the muscle, the bone, a nerve, a collapsed disc, whatever it may be. So I thought that was really fascinating. I'll link to these articles at trendhornpodcast.com, which remember, if you're a subscriber at trendhornpodcast.com, you get access to the bonus content and MP3 versions of my rebuttal videos I post on the YouTube channel. You can exclusively comment on the episodes, and you can check out the links I include in the show descriptions, including this one on the article from NPR and the New England Journal of Medicine interview with Jane Ballantyne. Let's go now to two other kinds of pain indexes. So not just pain about how you feel in general, but how certain things cause pain in you. The two I want to focus on, the first is called the Schmidt-Sting Pain Index, and it is an index that was developed by Justin O. Schmidt. He was an entomologist at the Carl Hayden B. Research Center in Arizona. And the Schmidt Pain Index is a score from 1 to 4 about how painful an insect or bug bite is. It goes from 1 is the least painful kind of insect bites to 4, the most painful. And actually, the scale is, we just talked about Marvel a week or two ago. It actually shows up in the movie Ant-Man. When Scott Lang wakes up at the house of Hank Pym, Hank's daughter Hope is there. Hank Pym is the original Ant-Man, a superhero who can, by using Pym particles, can shrink himself down to the level of an insect and actually even shrink further. He can go into the atomic and the quantum realm if he shrinks down small enough. And so the movie is about how Hank is recruiting Scott Lang to help him to keep the bad guy in the film from discovering the Pym particles and using this to do all kinds of bad things. So Scott wakes up at Pym's house because he had originally tried to rob the place. It was a test to see if he was a good burglar, a convoluted one, I will add. So he wakes up and Hope is there, and they have a discussion about why he's there. And Hank Pym is able to control ants to help him when he's really small, and Scott meets some of these ants.
Have you been standing there watching me sleep this whole time?
Yes.
Why?
Because the last time you were here, you stole something.
Oh. Hey, look.
Paraponera clavata. Giant tropical bullet ants ranked highest on the Schmidt Pain Index. They're here to keep an eye on you, and I can't. Dr. Pym's waiting for you downstairs.
Who?
Oh. Hey, whose pajamas are these?
And by the way, Paul Rudd is a national treasure. I will say this. He's an actor I thoroughly enjoy. Tom Hanks is probably number one. Tom Hanks should just live at the Smithsonian. I mean, he really is a national treasure. If they make National Treasure 3, it should be about Nicolas Cage trying to kidnap Tom Hanks to discover
Lincoln's gold or something like that, that the map is hidden in Tom Hanks, or Tom Hanks is the national treasure everybody's after. Paul Rudd comes in a close second. I enjoy him as an actor. But what Hope references, the Schmidt-Payne Index, as I said, is a real thing. So Schmidt published a number of papers on the subject and claims to have been stung by the majority of stinging Hymenoptera. His original paper in 1983 was a way to systematize and compare the hemolytic properties of insect venoms. A table contained in the paper included a column that rated sting pain, starting from zero for stings that are completely ineffective against humans, progressing through two, a familiar pain, such as a common bee or wasp, and finishing at a four for the most painful stings. Schmidt repeatedly refined the scale, included it in a paper that was published in 1990 that classified the stings of 78 species, culminating in a book published in 2016. So here's where they rank on the Schmidt Pain Index. Number one, bites or stings that you can register as pain would be things like a fire ant or a small bee. Even though I'm such a wuss, I remember once I was holding Matthew when we were swimming in the pool at our old apartment complex, and a bee landed on my shoulder. And I was like, I tried to like get off, but I was holding Matthew, so my hands were full. I was like, Laura, hold, take Matthew from me. And it stung me in the shoulder, and I was being such a baby about it. I'm like, no, I'm dying. The bee got me. The bees are in my mouth. Rah! Anyone for the deep cut? Nicolas Cage in The Wicker Man. I think I covered that in a Free For All Friday a long time ago about overacting in scenes. So they kill him with a wicker helmet filled with bees, CGI bees, and it's terrible. So on a one, Schmidt would say you're feeling only a slight pain. A digger bee would be another example. He describes pain level one as almost like of a digger bee. He says it's almost pleasant. A lover just bit your earlobe a little too hard. Okay, you know somebody who's going to let himself be stung by 80 different insects to assess their pain ranking? He's going to be a little bit of a weird cookie. So you'll see this as Schmidt goes on in his descriptions of the pain. It's sort of like how sommeliers, the people who will tell you how wine tastes, they'll give you the weirdest descriptions of wine. It's just like a can of tennis balls freshly opened or a unpacked garden hose or something like that. He's like the sommelier of insect pain. So he describes the pain of the digger bee. Almost pleasant. A lover just bit your earlobe a little too hard. He says a sweat bee is light and ephemeral, almost fruity, a tiny spark that singed a single hair on your arm. He goes on to say that pain level two on the Schmidt Index would be like a yellow jacket or a hornet. Also includes a sting of a termite raiding ant. Schmidt said, the debilitating pain of a migraine contained in the tip of your finger. So we're jumping up pretty high from one to two. When you get to two in the Schmidt Index, it's not a pleasant lover nibbling on your earlobe. So this is definitely, we're feeling pain here. A yellow jacket. And once again, he is a weird cookie. I love it. This is how a yellow jacket's sting feels. Hot and smoky, almost irreverent. Imagine W.C. Fields extinguishing a cigar on your tongue. Pain level three on the Schmidt scale is usually reserved for wasps. Schmidt also considered the sting of the Maricopa harvester ant as having a pain level of a three, saying, after 8 unrelenting hours of drilling into that ingrown toenail, you find the drill wedged into the toe. So the three would relate to a lot of wasps, and wasps have pretty painful stings if they get you, or so I hear. I've only probably had a one on the pain Schmidt index when that honeybee came after me. Finally, we have pain level four. In Schmidt's original index, that only had one example, the sting of the bullet ant. Schmidt has described the sting of the bullet ant as pure, intense, brilliant pain, like walking over flaming charcoal with a 3-inch nail embedded in your heel. He says that he later described, though, however, he added to it the tarantula hawk as having a 4 rating, saying that he described it as a blinding, fierce, and shockingly electric pain. Also, one wasp was able to make it to a level 4 on the Schmidt Index, and that was the warrior wasp. I love his response to this. Torture. You are chained in the flow of an active volcano. Why did I start this list? A question we're probably all asking, but it's neat to see where all our different insects lie on the Schmidt Pain Index. And now, as I promised you, we get to the last index. We'll talk about people whose pain hurts so good, who just love spicy food. Now, I hate spicy food. I am so bad when it comes to spicy food, whether it's spicy Mexican food, spicy Indian food, doesn't matter what it is. I'm terrible when it comes to spicy. I can barely handle it. I used to say that part of my ancestry is Irish, and because I'm part Irish, the spiciest thing I can have is a potato. So I don't like when food is very spicy. I can handle a little bit of mild spice, like the mild salsa, the mild curry, just a little bit of a pop to it is what I like. But when it gets to the really spicy stuff, I have to tap out. I can't do that. And to measure whether something is really spicy, there is a test to discover that. It's called the Scoville test. And so the Scoville test is a way to measure the spiciness of chili peppers, or specifically of capsaicinoids. And the test was developed by the American pharmacist Wilbur Scoville. So here's how the Scoville test works. In the Scoville organoleptic test, an exact weight of dried pepper is dissolved in alcohol to extract the heat components, the capsaicinoids. Then, and I know I'm mispronouncing it, I'm doing the best I can here. Then it's diluted in a solution of sugar water. Decreasing concentrations of the extracted capsaicinoids are given to a panel of 5 trained testers until a majority, at least 3 of them, can no longer detect the heat in a solution. The heat level is based on this dilution, rated in multiples of 100 Scoville heat units, or SHU. So, of course, measuring whether something is spicy is subjective. Some people, things that are like me, I'd say something is way spicier than it actually is. So I wouldn't be good to be a Scoville-trained spiciness taste tester. But other people can handle higher spiciness, but also be honest and objective to talk about when certain things are actually low and high and to accurately be able to determine that. The other problem with the Scoville test is sometimes your palate can be worn out quickly. If you have something that's spicy, it just destroys your tongue and your palate. It makes you more resistant to spiciness later on if it deadens your taste buds and your receptors on your palate. Even after a successful palate cleanser with some nice little orange sherbet, I would imagine, it can be hard to get it back. So I'm sure the test, you have to be careful in administering it that you don't give it to someone whose palate has already been deadened by eating something really spicy. So here's where things fall on the Scoville heat unit measure. So 0 to 700 SHU or Scoville heat units, 0 to 700 would be something like a bell pepper. Like either it has no spice or kick to it whatsoever, or it has the tiniest little kick you can imagine. And now I love myself some bell peppers. Those are delightful to add. Great to dip into a little bit of ranch. Bell pepper is a nice tasty snack. You go from 700 to 3,000 Scoville units. That's going to be mildly pungent. An example in that range would probably be like a poblano pepper. Next up is the moderately pungent ones. Those are 3,000 to 25,000 Scoville units. Good examples of these would be jalapenos. I hate jalapenos. If jalapenos are on my food and I take them off, the juice itself will still aggravate me. So once we get past about 3,000 Scoville units, that's where I start to tap out. And what also is hard with this is, and I love my wife, I love her family, but they're from New Mexico, and they're from southern New Mexico. And if you're in New Mexico, you know that the one thing New Mexico is famous for, aside from methamphetamines, are green chili, green and red chili, specifically green chili. And my wife lived in Las Cruces, New Mexico, which is right near Hatch, New Mexico, which is like super famous for their Hatch green chili. And so they love stuff that has green chili on it. And I add like green chili enchiladas. Like the McDonald's will put green chili, Hatch green chili on burgers. And I'm like, what are you doing? It turns out green chili has a Scoville unit. It can be as low as 1,000 if it's not really pungent. But on average, the median Scoville unit for a Hatch green chili is 4,500 Scovilles, and it oftentimes can go up to 7,000 or 8,000 units. And so that's too rich for my blood. I cannot handle it. It makes food not enjoyable. So once you get past the poblano peppers, the 3,000 Scoville units, that's where I have to bow out. But we're barely getting into the Scoville units now. Between 3,000 to 25,000 is where you have jalapenos, Hatch green chili. You go up more to the highly pungent, that would be 25,000 to 70,000 Scoville units. That's where you get cayenne peppers, Tabasco sauce would be at highly pungent. Then when you go above 80,000 Scoville units, that's where you get like the really spicy stuff. Like when you go to the taco, you know, the salad, not the salad bar, the salsa bar at a Mexican restaurant, you'll see mild, moderate. The spiciest one they'll usually have there are habanero chilies. Habanero, I've had it before and it made my throat close in on itself. A habanero is usually at 80,000 or above. But we're still pretty far away from the spiciest stuff out there when it comes to the Scoville heat units. But before we get to those, that you sometimes, I used to think that these super spicy peppers only existed in like cartoons, like Crazy Hot. I think of season 8, episode 9 of The Simpsons, where Homer goes to the big chili cook-off. So he goes and he walks in and they play the Wild West music and he twirls his tasting spoons like, wow, wow, wow. Homer goes, he tries Ned Flanders' 5-alarm chili and he says, barely 2 alarms, Ned. And Ned starts crying, I know it's 2, maybe 2.5 at best. Daddy, are you going to jail? I don't know, son. I don't know. But then Homer goes to Chief Wiggum, who tries to have the spiciest chili imaginable that's going to break Homer. And this is their interaction.
Hello, Chief.
Afternoon, Homer. Care for some chili? I've added an extra ingredient just for you. The merciless peppers of Quetzalcoatlanango. Grown deep in the jungle primeval by the inmates of a Guatemalan insane asylum.
Wiggy, my chili's getting cold.
So then only a bit of it touches Homer's tongue and his eyes turn red and he tries to like eat ice cream and it melts away before it can reach his tongue. He tries to down a bunch of beer and Marge yells at him because he promised he wouldn't be drinking. So then he goes and drinks juice and feels bad for himself. And later later he coats his mouth with wax to be able to eat the peppers. But then they mess up his stomach and he starts to hallucinate because of it.
Flanders, you gotta help me.
Well, sure, buddy, I'd be happy to help out. What can I do?
Doodly do, diddly doodly 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 hobbly hoodly hobbly 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 goobble gobble goobble gobble gobble gobble.
And then leads to Homer going on a spirit quest and understanding, you know, treating his marriage more important, his family more important. This is season 8. Remember that I've said this before on the podcast. The Simpsons really went downhill after season 9. A lot of the good writers left. I've barely watched any season episodes after season 9. For me, you can't go wrong with seasons 2 through probably the beginning of season 9. But the insane pepper that Chief Wiggum talks about, there are real life analogs, like these peppers that are dangerous if you try to eat them, that people try to grow them so that they have the maximum Scoville units you can possibly imagine. So when you go on the Scoville ranking, the highest ones that are ranked up there, you know, the regular ones that you might eat start at 0, go up to 80,000 for habanero. Scoville units go up into the millions, though. So when you get to about 1.5 million Scoville units, that's the same intensity of police-issued pepper spray. So imagine just trying to eat like pepper spray. What it would do to you. That's 1.5 million Scoville units. And then until 2017, the hottest pepper that reached that level that was even past police issue pepper spray was the Carolina Reaper, developed by Ed Curry. So this is a video on Wired that talks about how he is, that gives a little bit of an insight to who Ed Curry is. And you can imagine what kind of person would try to make peppers at 1.5 million, 2 million, 3 million Scoville units. Well, this gives you a little bit of insight into him and what these peppers are like.
Your hands will start shaking. Your heart will start going faster. You get sweaty. Your eyes water. Your skin flushes. The mucous membranes run, and so you get snot pouring out your nose.
Ed Curry is the evil genius who brought the world the Carolina Reaper, the world's hottest hot pepper.
A Carolina Reaper is a beautiful fruit that is hiding a package of evil inside, and it's the hottest pepper in the world. I get to hurt people from all over the world every single day. I might have a little sadistic streak to me.
The aptly named Curry has been hyper-focused on one thing since 1981, hot peppers. More specifically, he's obsessed with crossbreeding different peppers to make them as hot as possible by upping their level of capsaicin, the ingredient that gives hot peppers their heat. And the Carolina Reaper is an absolute capsaicin beast.
So that's how, so you get that Curry is the one who came up with it was the hottest pepper until 2017. An article in the Chicago Tribune says that in 2017, it was unseated by the dragon's breath pepper. But the dragon's breath didn't wait long because Curry came back and he said, I'm not going to be beaten. And he's come up with what is now believed to be the spiciest pepper out there. And that is Pepper X, which is even hotter. It's clocks in at 3.18 million Scoville units. So you can't eat Pepper X. It doesn't exist for you just to eat as a whole pepper. And I wouldn't recommend anyone eat it. You can watch challenges online of people eating Carolina Reapers, and it's painful to watch. You can see people like, oh, it hurts so much, I can't do it. There's a video actually online of Irish people eating the Carolina Reaper, like the people who are most susceptible to spicy food trying to eat that. So Curry is still ranking at the top there of Pepper X. Hey, if you've ever actually had the Pepper X sauce or a Carolina Reaper, or if you are a huge fan of spicy foods, leave a comment on the episode at trendhornpodcast.com if you're a premium subscriber. Otherwise, be sure to leave a review at iTunes or Google Play. We would love to hear from you, see how the podcast is going, and it's a great way to share the podcast with others to see that it's worth their time, effort, and energy. Thank you guys so much. Love hanging out with you on Free For All Friday to talk about who knows what, and I hope that you all just have a very blessed weekend, a happy weekend, and you know what? If eating super spicy food makes you happy, you go right on and you do that. Thanks a lot, everybody.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.